Dan Tangerlini is the administrator of the General Services Administration, at least for two more days, Dan. Congratulations on your departure, and thank you for your time as you get ready to wrap up. What have people asked you the most as you've talked to folks about leaving GSA and legacy and what you've accomplished and all of those kinds of things?
I think people have asked, you know, what do you think about the last 3 years, and what do you think are some of the most important things that that happened here? And I think the most important takeaway for me was just how incredibly talented, smart, and hardworking the GSA folks are, and how fundamental and important the GSA mission is. When I came in April of 2012. We were in a bit of an existential crisis. People were asking. There are more than a few people on the Hill who are saying maybe this should be the end of GSA. Maybe we should just get rid of it. It seems to create more problems than it solves. Mm-hmm. And I'm really pleased that over the last 3 years, working closely with the folks here in GSA, working closely with people on the Hill, and then with tremendous support from the president and this administration, we've begun to describe for people why Harry Truman had it right when he set up GSA, and recognized that there's tremendous value in doing things once and well in the federal government, that sharing resources, sharing solutions is a way of actually allowing people to have more time to focus on mission and on outcome.
Was there a chain of events that you think turned the tide in Congress? Because I recall there were any number of different possibilities. Break it up, eliminate it altogether, so on and so forth. Was there something or some chain of events that happened that you think got that message through?
Well, where I think the most important chain of events, if there was one, was really a bipartisan level of support for us to dig into the GSA mission, dig into the GSA operations. And so I really credit senators and congressmen from both sides of the aisle, while very, very angry about the circumstances that led to my coming here, actually giving us time to conduct the top-to-bottom review, actually giving us a forum to discuss the findings of the top-to-bottom review, and then supporting us over and over again in our efforts subsequent to the work we did there to realign our staff, to dramatically reduce our administrative costs, to refocus around our core programs. We've seen a big turnaround in the amount of resources we're getting back into the public building service program. It's not as much as we think we need, or as much as we think we could use to drive down the cost of government. But I have to say, if you look at the delta between 2012 and now the president's FY16 budget, it's quite dramatic.
The last time you and I talked, we talked about GSA hosting the government's data benchmarking effort.
Right.
Where does that stand as you get ready to leave, and what are some examples of the successes that you've had there?
I would say that is one of the things I'm most proud to have played some small part of. Co-chairing that effort with Beth Cobert over at OMB, and she has been such a passionate supporter and leader, really committed to making sure that that benchmarking project gets off the ground and keeps going. And what I'm excited about is we're going to go out and collect the second round of the kind of part one benchmarks. Those are the basic fundamental questions about what we call the bigger than a breadbox metrics. Mm-hmm. You know, how much does it cost to do finance operations in one agency versus the next? We're also launching and have launched the phase two, which is the quality metrics and the performance metrics, and doing surveys and polling around the entire USG entity, asking people what do they think of the quality of this kind of work. I still think we're in the early days of this, but I also believe that this is the beginning of something truly transformative in the way we measure the basic, if you will, boiler room operations of the federal government. I believe that there's a lot of opportunity for more efficiency there. There's a huge opportunity for more effectiveness there. Those are resources that can be committed to modernizing those processes and dramatically improving mission outcomes.
You and Beth and I talked about the idea of, excuse me, of institutionalizing those efforts, because They don't strike me as particularly partisan, and
right.
the data use is valuable no matter where you're coming from. You can use it to analyze anything. What have you done specifically? What do you hope Beth continues to do to make sure that institutionalization happens, since you're not going to be in control of that anymore?
I think the smart thing that Beth did was to really root the benchmark effort within the councils. The CX Council, CFO, CAO, CIGO, the various different chief officer councils, and really said to folks, look, this is a tool that's going to make you more effective, that's going to make give you an opportunity to understand where the best practices are. So I think the way to institutionalize anything in the federal government is to really get the people who ultimately run the federal government in the long term, and that's the civil service and the SES, to buy into and own that outcome. Putting it in GSA, which is a non-political agency institution, putting it in the Office of Government-Wide Policy, really realizes in many ways the point for why OGP was created. And the idea was to root administrative policy in a non-political part of the government organization that does have the horizontality. GSA is one of three agencies that goes across government, OMB, OPM, and GSA. And so by putting the actual maintenance of the effort within OGP and then really giving the ownership of the effort to the councils, I think that Beth has been very smart about finding a way to institutionalize it.
Are you confident, though, that all of those CXOs are buying in and will continue to buy in when it's not high profile and not necessarily cool and in the news?
So I actually think it's always going to be cool, but that's because I'm a bit of a data geek. And I think as a former CXO myself, I sat on a number of those councils. Look, having some sense of what the guy next door or the woman running the IT in that agency is doing, and if they're getting better outcomes, I don't know. I'd say 99% of everyone I've met within this work are really interested in finding better outcomes. So I think if people can see how they're doing relative to other people, there's a natural competitive spirit that's going to align incentives and get people excited about it. I don't know. I honestly believe that there's enough value. I honestly believe that there's enough interest that it will stay. If it doesn't stay, then I was wrong. That would not be the first time. And I think that would be a shame.
If we came back and revisited this 2 or 5 years from now, what would you be looking at to say, yes, it stuck, yes, it was successful, and it's still being utilized effectively?
What I would look at is that at the very high level would be a massive amount of effort around deduplication within the federal government. I think we spend money on the same thing too many times. I think that the CX councils will become far more active if this is successful in looking at best practices and finding opportunities for shared services. I think that if this is successful, you will see agencies looking at the kind of consolidations in the CX function that you've seen at GSA, which have resulted in a 16% reduction in administrative expenses within GSA. All money that we've been able to put into improving our technology, enhancing our program, or returning to the taxpayer. Those are the three things that any good manager is looking to do. If this worked, you'll see more of that.
Shift gears for a moment. Your colleague Tom Sharp, who I see sitting at his desk in the open environment here.
Isn't that great? If I have a question, I just jump up and walk over and talk to Tom Sharp.
It is certainly very innovative. As my colleague Jason Miller reports, he was recently at the White House several times in the last couple of weeks to talk about category management.
Right.
What's the sign that people should take away from the fact that the White House is paying attention to something like category management at that level?
So I joined the administration early in 2009, and this administration has been focused and passionate about dramatically improving the effectiveness of government. I think what you see is, as we've worked through the last 6 years, and this is an administration that's had a pretty long to-do list, starting from a global financial crisis to winding down multiple wars to a very difficult set of issues on the world stage, complicated issues politically, a shutdown and a debt crisis. But all along the way, there's been a commitment to making the work of government better, smarter, more efficient, and more effective. You've seen the work that we've done around digital services to try to learn from the mistakes of healthcare.gov. You've seen the work that was done around the Recovery Act. I mean, look at the record of the Recovery Act. I know that's kind of back in the sands of time, but I think it's actually a very powerful management lesson of what executive level focus, continuous reporting, and real attention to the bottom line can get you in the way of results. So I think that the category management interest by the president is really part of a longer expression of focus and interest on making sure that the government can be as efficient and effective as possible. I joined Tom in that most recent meeting, and I can tell you there was a high level of engagement at the executive level of saying, how can we make acquisition faster, more efficient, and more effective, while at the same time preserving and expanding opportunities for small businesses? Mm-hmm. Look, an acquisition system that is complicated, opaque, and expensive is in no one's best interest. It's not in the best interest of the taxpayer. It's not in the best interest of the government. It's not in the best interest of our vendors. And so actually going out and trying to create some transparency, trying to give people visibility into what sources and what mechanisms or what vehicles are available, mm-hmm. we think will actually drive down redundancy, push up value, and increase opportunity. But it's an experiment. We're kicking it off. I'm glad I was here present at the creation. And like you, I'll be watching from home to see how it works out.
What's the genesis of something like that, though? What gets something like category management on the radar screen of the President of the United States in the first place for somebody to say in the White House, we should take time on the schedule of the president for him to learn about this?
So the president's a very engaged manager and very interested in the operations of government. So he hears, he's heard from
sure.
people how painful the process is from every side. Our work around category management really came out of our top-to-bottom review on the Federal Acquisition Service and asking ourselves, look, what is the 10-year horizon of FAS? If we just keep doing the same thing that we're doing, and hopefully, we think we'd do it harder. And we were seeing declining market share for FAS. We were seeing declining relevance for FAS. And so really we challenged ourselves to go into a green field or onto a clean whiteboard and say, what would the future of acquisition look like? And what we heard over and over is that people want the same kind of availability of information, speed of acquisition that you get in your personal life. In particularly in the last 5 or 10 years, radically transformed the way you and I get to go to market for anything from travel to, birthday gifts to, whatever it is you want.
Mm-hmm.
We need that same kind of transformation to happen within the federal acquisition environment. What we learned was, in order to create that kind of digital business system, you actually have to create essentially the equivalent of the internet.
Mm-hmm.
The information that people actually are interested in garnering is not available. Acquisition systems aren't connected. They don't talk to each other. Much of our process is still on paper. So starting with category management, giving people ownership over gathering as much information as possible, putting it into the hallways, opening those hallways for all 60,000 acquisition professionals in government so that they can have a single golden source of data,
mm-hmm.
we think that that's the power of massive transparency that the president was talking about when he was running for the first term. And so I think what you have is an interest in effective government, a concern about the way things are going, an effort on the part of this agency to try to remake it and rethink it in a way that's consistent with the broader policy. You bring that together, and that would be of interest to the president, and that's why I think he spent the time with us talking about it.
We've spoken about the commoditization factor, and you're not worried about all the data that becomes available, turning various products and services into commodities. Industry still is worried about that.
I think it's reasonable for industry to worry about commoditization. You know, I went to business school. I know what that means for pricing. But look, there are commodities out there, and the American taxpayer should never pay more than a commodity price for a commodity. We also know that there are specialties. We also know that there's particular expertise. We should be willing to pay the appropriate price to get the highest quality, best value outcome. Right now, we have a system that's so opaque that we treat those high-value things as commodities, and we treat commodities as high-value things. And we think by transparency, by really providing information, by providing an ability for people to dialogue about what they're actually after and what they're trying to get and what the outcome is, by putting things out there like challenge.gov, that we actually think that we can have a better, smarter conversation around that.
I think what you're saying makes a lot of sense, and it's exactly right. I think what industry's fear is not with the GSA effort so much anymore as it is with what's actually going to happen among the COs, whether that dialoguing will actually happen and whether they'll be willing to go and use the data that you're putting in to the hallways and make decisions based on all of the information and not just the prices. I know that's not in your bailiwick. There's nothing you can do about that. But do you understand what that fear is, where it's coming
again,
from?
I'll say it again. I really do understand that fear. The point is, though, that I would argue that that fear is as live and as reasonable for the system we have now. In fact, I would argue it's worse because there's so much less transparency. There's so much less connection from CO to CO. If you walk a mile in a CO's shoes, you know that they are ultimately responsible for the decision, and they need to be able to justify it and explain it with the many levels of oversight we have in government, from the IG to congressional investigation to even criminal investigation. So giving them a forum, giving them a platform, giving them a place where they can exchange ideas among each other and they can find where other people have used something successfully, we think that's the key to actually giving COs the confidence they need to make the choices that aren't the simple ones, that aren't simply, best price. If there is a best value proposition out there, what I want is a CO to have a relationship with another CO to have the confidence that they can support it.
Is there going to be a way for industry to participate in that at all, to help feed the information that goes into that, to be able to differentiate? I didn't just provide a widget. I provided a widget plus in this particular case, and that's why the numbers might look the way they look?
I think if it's going to work, the answer to that question is a resounding absolute yes. We're still figuring out the basics of, essentially creating this internet. We're still trying to plug things from one side of the, organization into the other side of the organization. So I would encourage industry to stay on top of the issue, to stay connected to our FAST commissioner, who's in civil service, SES. He's going to be here beyond me and beyond the administration. I would encourage the fourth estate. I would encourage the people like you who really cover these issues in depth to hold us accountable to make sure that they are included. It only works if there is continuous and meaningful engagement with the private sector, because what we're interested in is great outcomes for the agencies. And we know, and that's why we're going into the acquisition environment to begin with, we know that there are better outcomes we can get from industry than exist on the property.
Let's talk about the federal real estate footprint. A lot of changes in the way that Federal Buildings, Public Building Service has done business since you came in. Norm Dong in place now, and by all accounts doing a terrific job in that slot. Can we expect to see a lot more approaches to federal space management like we've seen with the FBI building, Federal Center Southwest, those types of approaches? And do you expect that those, if they continue, will be primarily budget-driven, or will there be a strategic and visionary component to them too?
Well, I would hope that there isn't a difference between something being strategic and budget, right? I think actually the budget, when done well and when done right, is actually a statement of strategy and direction, that there's some policy intentionality behind it. I think what we've tried to do on the real estate side, and one of the things, it's a very kind of fundamental and geeky thing I'm proud that we were able to do with the position of the Public Building Service Commissioner, is, you know, Norm is a civil servant SES. Norm also will continue beyond me and continue beyond the administration. And I think maintaining that kind of consistency and focus and really investing in our SES core and saying, look, we believe that you have the skills and the ability, the talent and experience to really make this stuff work on a long-term scale. So I think with Norm there, I think we'll see some consistency around the idea that real estate should be part of the strategic discussion about how do we deliver mission and how do we deliver outcomes. And I would say that what we're now able to do, in part because of the connection between the stronger connection between PBS and FAS and between PBS FAS and OCSIT and this idea of leveraging technology to deliver services and outcomes has allowed us to rethink the way we approach space. You're sitting in a massive rethinking of that. Mm-hmm. And so what we want to do is encourage agencies to say, look, you need to start building your physical footprint to reflect the way you're going to be delivering services for the next 10, 50 years. You know, rather than saying, let me just go and render again the way we delivered those services over the last 10 or 50 years. And a lot has changed. You know, you reach into your pocket, you pull out that smartphone, that's only 7 years old. Mm-hmm. And it's dramatically changed the way people do everything in their personal lives. I keep challenging people in the government to say, have you changed the way you deliver your services in your agency as quickly as this has for you outside of your government service? And we need space that supports that. Now, in order to do that, there's going to be some investment necessary. Things like the FBI building, things like Federal Triangle Southwest, is really this interesting opportunity to say, look, we've dramatically changed the nature of the space we need. And, oh, by the way, the American people, Congress, and prior administrations were smart enough to make an investment so that we now have asset value that we can leverage to make that subsequent investment mm-hmm. to improve the way we deliver services. So we're going to look for every opportunity, I hope, going forward, to find places where there's captured asset value that we can push back into improving the way we deliver services. But in that vein, we need to reestablish a willingness on the part of particularly Congress to invest in those assets to begin with and look at making sure we aren't renting more property than we should, buying property where it makes the most economic sense so that we have left for subsequent generations the ability for them to make that kind of same going forward asset flip.
If I listen between the lines, it sounds like you're making the same argument the Defense Department makes on weapon systems. Don't make us buy stuff we don't need. Let us what we need to meet the mission of the agency.
It's a little different. What we're saying is we should be willing to buy stuff. We should be willing to invest in the real estate so that we can get the run-up of the value. Look, mm-hmm. the FBI building, when it was built in, you know, I'm going to make up a number, 1960. It was roughly then. Mm. You know, the federal government bought that land on Pennsylvania Avenue, which was worth very little. Very little. And we made an investment in the core of the city because it was the right thing to do, it was responsible, it was close to DOJ headquarters. It was just a very good, solid, smart investment. And we built a building whose aesthetics people can debate.
And have.
Actually, very few people actually debate it.
That's a good point.
Position is
a fair point.
Pretty unified. But we used that building for 50 years. We got 50 good years of service out of it. Maybe the last few have been less than good. But we got 50 years of service out of it. And we now have that asset that we can then trade to make the investment in the next FBI headquarters, the one that hopefully will last for the at least the next 50 years. That is a recognition that budgetary investments of the sort we're talking about in real estate, they go well beyond the one-year appropriation cycle. And it's very hard, if we're fighting through one-year appropriation cycles, to get the resources necessary to make those investments. That's the St. E's story in a nutshell. Look, we are going to spend, and are spending, vastly more on leases and on all the associated inefficiencies of spreading DHS across four dozen properties. We know that. We can prove it. GAO has proven it. CRS has proven it. And yet we struggle to get the minimum necessary to keep that project going to make the necessary investment.
Why do you think that is? I mean, I've seen the ROI numbers. They're pretty convincing.
And the federal budget doesn't work off of ROI. The federal budget is scored and balanced on an annual basis. Now, the president in this year's, in his fiscal year 16 budget request, had said, look, we've got to start at least a dialogue about thinking about this differently. And so for the first time, he's proposed in the fiscal year 16 budget for GSA, advanced appropriations for FY 17. He's saying to Congress, I'm proposing not only the amount for this fiscal year, for next fiscal year as well. How about you appropriate 2 years of projects? How about you appropriate 2 years of investment so that there's some consistency and some focus, so we don't run into the problem we ran into with the San Ysidro Land Port of Entry, the busiest border crossing in the world? We got stuck in a multi-year, many, many phase a construction project that delays traffic, you know, limits the border security because of these appropriation cycles. We're happy. I went out there just last week. We're happy to say that actually in the last budget that the Congress passed, the FY15 Cromnibus, there is the last phase of funding for the San Ysidro Land Port of Entry, ending a more than a decade-long slog. And people are already seeing the benefits of the new lanes we've added, and that's just the beginning. So there's clear, obvious value we can bring to the American taxpayer and we can bring to the people we serve. We can save them money. It just requires some investment up front. So the president's engaging in that conversation with this FY16 budget, and hopefully we'll get a fair hearing.
Another legacy that you'll leave, Dan, is the leap into the digital world. Well, we've talked about digital services a little bit, and 18F is the poster child for that. We're seeing that replicated now all across the government. Let's look at a 2 or 5 year jump into the future. If we look at 18F in that scope, how will we know that it's achieved what you and your colleagues and the White House have wanted it to achieve?
I think actually in many ways 18F has already achieved kind of beyond our wildest expectations. What we now have are agencies pulling service requests out of 18F, asking for advice, asking for how they can be a better consumer of IT and digital services. This is another one where I think the concerns of the industry might be missing actually the benefit to the industry. What we want to do is demonstrate for agencies that IT investments, carefully done, thoughtfully done, done in an agile way, can actually have dramatic improvements in service delivery and outcome, which will then generate more interest in that kind of investment. Mm-hmm. So I actually think that this is part of a bigger effort to say, look, with all the money we put into this, we should be getting dramatically better outcomes in terms of the way we deliver services and the way people experience the federal government. I believe you're going to see over the next 2 to 5 years a dramatic increase in improvement in the quality of digital services in the federal government. We've been talking about it for a long time, but people can see it and feel it in their personal lives, in their private lives, in their non-government work lives. I think people are really going to start seeing it in the government side. I think the passage of FITARA, parts of it will help with that. I think the real attention on the part of the administration on thinking about ways to nest digital service activities within agencies are going to help with that. And I think 18F is going to be, a big part of that boiler room, producing steam that's going to make this stuff move forward.
You have a bit of an edge, too, because since you went first, you had an opportunity to get into the marketplace. Some agencies are a little concerned about where they're going to find the people to be able to staff up their digital services efforts.
And I think, we have 100 people, but there are literally thousands, tens of thousands, maybe even hundreds of thousands of folks out there who are really interested in making an impact through serving their government. I also think that we should recognize the fact that maybe we don't need to make a lot of 18Fs, right? We should have these digital service cadres within the agencies really understanding what the problems are, and then we should have maybe one really good, strong 18F that is then helping them get to the minimally viable product stage, and then we should have a really robust industry and contractor community that we're able to reach into in a way we just haven't been before, who then helps us do the really hard work. So I think what we need to do is build an ecosystem. And we need to include industry in that ecosystem, and we should try to avoid building kind of parallel and competing ecosystems. Mm-hmm.
That's a really good message for industry to hear. I'm sure they'll be happy to hear you say that. I don't think they've heard that message or heard it that clearly before. Why do you think that is? Any thoughts about why that might be?
I'm not sure why, because every time I talk about it, that's how I talk about it.
They're still leery, though.
Yeah, I think, if you were to ask a room of folks from the industry whether they like the status quo, raise your hand if you like the status quo, you would get very few hands. If you were then to turn around and ask that same room, okay, how about this change? Do you like this change? You would also get very few hands. And I learned early on, particularly when I was working in transportation here in the city, that the only thing worse than the status quo oftentimes is change, right? People are nervous about it, and I understand. They've built their livelihoods, they've built their tuition payments, their mortgage around a certain way of doing things. Even when that way of doing things people know is not the best way of doing things, they get nervous about what it means for them if you start changing it. But we have a change imperative. We just need to change the way we do things. The American people are demanding it. Frankly, they deserve it. It's crazy that you still have to fill out paper forms for so much of government service. That's just insane in this era. So how do we overcome that? And I think part of that is by demonstrating for agencies they can very quickly and very easily and very cost-effectively be effective in delivering digital services. We think 18F is part of that, and we think the industry is an even bigger part of that.
I noted in getting ready to come in and talk to you today that you are the first GSA administrator to leave on, shall we say, his or her own terms. In 10 years, Steve Perry in 2005, who now, by the way, has a terrific gig as the head of the Pro Football Hall of Fame.
Wow.
So if you get the Cooperstown gig, I'll look forward to coming up and seeing you there. I don't know how that'll work out.
I think I would have to learn a bunch more about football to qualify. I don't know. I'm sure there are people who would debate the assertion. I won't argue it other than to say that wasn't the reason behind my departure, but I am happy that we've done another thing for kind of establishing regular order in this organization. And part of that regular order is the possibility of a regular transition of a political appointee. Mm-hmm. We're not supposed to be here forever. We're supposed to serve a term and serve an administration. And so the fact that we're able to demonstrate that in this agency, like most agencies, there can be that kind of peaceful transition of civilian government. That's a nice thing to be part of.
Peaceful is an interesting word. I spoke to a career here at this agency recently and said, what do you think the transition that Dan's leaving means, and or what do you take away from it? And this person said, it's a lot more calm than it was a couple of years ago.
Yeah, 3 years ago was probably more exciting than anyone wanted to be part of. I'm just very proud of this organization for figuring a path through that storm and coming out a stronger and, I think, better organization, one that has not increased but just reinforced its commitment to delivering the best quality of shared services for the federal agencies so that they can, in turn, deliver the best quality outcomes for the American people. That's an incredible thing to be a part of.
What's the biggest difference in the culture, do you think?
You know, it's an interesting question because a lot of people ask me about the culture of this organization when I came in. And there was, at some level, an interest, a desire, or a willingness to indict the culture of the organization for getting into the kind of trouble it got into. I would argue that it's very hard in an organization of 12,000 people to find the culture. And oftentimes, they're kind of competing cultures. There are multiple cultures. And so what we've done, hopefully over the last 3 years, is reinforce the service culture, reinforce the meaning of what it means to be a public servant, to serve the American people, and to serve those agencies. And that was a culture that was well established when I got here. And that was a culture that has been operating for the entire life of this agency. I just hope we've done enough to really reinforce that as the dominant culture at GSA and really establish the GSA brand as being one that associates itself every day with that perspective.
To my knowledge, Mr. Perry doesn't have any interest in leaving the Pro Football Hall of Fame in Canton. The Cooperstown gig, the Baseball Hall of Fame, probably pretty secure with the gentleman that has it. So what do you do next?
I don't know. Is there a soccer Hall of Fame? That might be something.
There is. Yeah. It's actually very close to the Baseball Hall of Fame.
Really?
And I keep hearing Metro.
I'm not sure why, but that maybe people are just talking about Metro. I had a lot of fun nearly a decade ago serving as the interim general manager at Metro, but I just don't think that that's the kind of fun I want to have right now. But I appreciate the suggestion. No one's actually called me about it, so I'll be happy if that stays in that way. I actually am, you know, working on some ideas. Nothing I can talk about right now, but I'll let you know when I figure it out.
Well, I guess I'll have to figure out what to do with these fare cards then that I can't get to work right.
Yeah, well, actually, they actually have a very good customer service center. If you go on their website, I think they can help you out with that.
I'm sure you didn't have anything to do with that either. Thank you very much for your time, Administrator. Congratulations, Dan.
Thank you very much. I appreciate the opportunity to talk a little bit about the work that the folks here at GSA have been doing. I appreciate your interest in the subject, and I hope you'll stay engaged, too, because it's incredibly important to us.